And welcome back. Dan Rodericks here. Thank you again for joining us for the second hour of Midday. When Matthew Van Dyke bought a motorcycle and headed to the Middle East a few years ago, the 20-something Baltimore native was on a self-proclaimed crash course in manhood. Inspired by the films of the Australian adventurer Albie Mangles, Matt Van Dyke brought his video camera along and quickly found himself addicted to the adrenaline rush that came with traversing the deserts and going incognito into some of the world's most dangerous regions, including Afghanistan. It was all for fun and thrill-seeking, that is, until the Arab Spring hit Libya, a country where Matt Van Dyke had formed some of his closest friendships during his travels. When, in 2011, he heard about the rebellion and the harsh retaliation of then-ruler Muammar Gaddafi, the once shy and sheltered Matt Van Dyke decided to fight against the regime alongside his new friends in Libya. The fun and thrill-seeking was over, and Van Dyke had embarked on a new chapter in his crash course in manhood, one filled with purpose as well as potentially deadly consequences. The documentary film Point and Shoot, directed by Marshall Curry, chronicles Matt Van Dyke's transformation from the video game-addicted, movie-loving young man from Baltimore to impassioned freedom fighter. It won the prize for Best Documentary at this year's Tribeca Film Festival in New York just a couple months ago, and it's been making its way to film festivals across the country. Matt Van Dyke joins us now to talk about the film, his battles, and his travels. Also, we'll hear about a short documentary which he directed and produced called Not Anymore, A Story of Revolution. The film explores the Syrian civil war through the lens of a rebel fighter and a young journalist in the war-torn city of Aleppo. Matt Van Dyke, nice to have you back on Midday. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show again.
Yeah, and congratulations on the award from Tribeca Film Festival. Actually, that was in April 2014, just in April. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
You know, there's a question I think I've asked you before when you were on the show, and the film made me want to go back and ask you about this again. The first time I heard the name Matt Van Dyke and what was going on, you had disappeared. You were in Libya. You were described as a journalist. And I remember, journalist, huh? Matt Van Dyke, who is this guy? I never heard of him before. So, of course, we all Googled you, looked up to see what you had written, if anything. I think I found a piece that you had written for The Examiner, examiner.com, when you were embedded with a U.S. military unit in Afghanistan. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty much the only one of the very few articles I ever wrote. I was actually never paid for an article.
Right. So
they went out of business the day after I made the front page with that Examiner.
Is that
article.
Right? Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, so we'll just clear that up from the beginning. I think the press here in Maryland and elsewhere described you as a journalist, a missing journalist, and then some of us corrected that later.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the press like a one-word label. I had written an article before, so they just started calling me a journalist, and I've been trying to get them to stop doing that ever since.
Okay. But, well, we won't do it today.
Good, thank you.
Yeah. Well, Matt, I found the film, it's really well done, really interesting, and revealing some aspects about you that I don't think I got to in earlier conversations with you, and that is about what set you on this adventure to begin with. We picked up the story with you in Libya, but before that, you were on a motorcycle trying to make a travel film, basically, right?
Right. I was trying to make a motorcycle adventure documentary, and as part of that, because I had to get visas for so many countries, the reason there wasn't much about me on the internet is because I deliberately stayed off the internet to avoid having problems getting visas. Even the Examiner article you mentioned was available as a PDF, but not through the Examiner site because I didn't want it Google searchable. That's an agreement I had with the Examiner.
Hmm.
So, yeah, that's why there wasn't much when you Googled Matt Van Dyke.
For those of us listening here in Maryland, in the Baltimore area, just let's go a little bit about into your background a bit here. You grew up, and the film makes it clear that you liked the movies as a kid, and you were enamored of movie heroes.
Sure. I mean, I was a young kid growing up in America in the 80s and 90s. My mother liked action movies, so that's what I watched growing up.
You saw yourself as Indiana Jones.
At some point in my youth, yes.
And
I'd wanted to be an archaeologist, and then eventually I wanted to work for the government, and then never did. Now I'm on a way different path.
I mentioned this Australian adventurer, Albie Mangles. I didn't know much about him until I saw a reference to him again in your film and went and looked him up a little bit. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about him?
Albie Mangles is an Australian adventure filmmaker from the 70s and 80s. And he made some films that were mostly very popular in Australia, but in around the year 2000, the Travel Channel in the United States had a deal with him. They took his footage. They made a series called Albie Mangles Adventure Bound. And that's where I first saw him. He would go and film himself on adventures all around the world. There was sort of a first-person adventure filmmaking that really appealed to me.
I have this question as I was watching the film. You were looking for an adventure. You said you went on a crash course in manhood. You were in your mid-20s. You're still living here in Baltimore. Your mother, your grandmother were sort of taking care of you. You had kind of a pampered existence. You said, I think you used the word spoiled to describe yourself. And
It was spoiled, but not in an obnoxious way, just in a perhaps doting a little bit too much on me type thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to UMBC and I lived at home. My mother tried to get me onto campus, except because I lived so close, they wouldn't take me onto campus for dormitory housing because, you know, there was a shortage of housing. So I lived at home during college. And then when I went to Georgetown for my master's degree, I did live in an apartment in Georgetown, but my family would still come and bring me food and come and pick up my dirty laundry and bring me clean laundry. And then I'd move to Delaware after graduating, where I was living mostly on my own, but still at my family's house in Fenwick Island. So I needed to change things quickly. You know, I'd reached my mid-20s and I needed to break out of that only child type existence quickly.
Well, this is a question I had. Some young men in your situation might have joined the military. Some might have become a journalist, signed on as a foreign correspondent, just took a chance, went someplace, and decided to write stories. What about the military? Had you considered that?
I hadn't really considered it at the time because I had spent all that energy and time getting my master's degree with the hope of working for the CIA. So my inclination was to work for the government, but in the intelligence community. And when the war in Iraq started, I didn't think it was good U.S. policy, so I didn't want to work on the war in Iraq. And so then when I moved to Delaware for a little while, I did some roofing and painting boats at a boatyard, trying to figure out what step to take. That's when I remembered the Albie Mangles films, and I realized that's really what I wanted to do. And I needed to see the region for myself, that I had a master's degree with a Middle East concentration, but I'd never been to the Arab world. And I also needed to do a lot of self-improvement to become more independent. So that seemed like a good way to do it.
Okay.
Me.
Well, it certainly was unique, Matt. So you got a motorcycle, you got a helmet outfitted with a video camera, and you headed off. You went to, started in Gibraltar, you head up into Africa from there. And what year was this, by the way? This is like 2009, 2010?
This is 2007.
Oh, seven, even earlier. Okay.
I spent 4 years on the road.
Okay. And just for our listeners here, could you track for us a bit your travels during that time?
Sure. I crossed by ferry over to Morocco. I broke my collarbone in a motorcycle accident. I think it was my fourth day in the country. So I had to come back to America, have some x-rays done at Harbor Hospital Center, and then went back 6 weeks later. Resumed, went down as far south as Mauritania, and then back up through Morocco, took a ferry to get to Europe, and then Tunisia, Libya, where I made a lot of great friends, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Turkey, and then Iraq. I spent a lot of 2008, 2009, and 2010 in Iraq. And then onward eventually to Iran and Afghanistan.
It's interesting you mentioned Iraq because I wanted to ask you about that. We're going to listen to a clip here from Point and Shoot, the documentary film we're discussing with its subject, Matthew Van Dyke. While working as a journalist, sort of in quotes, in Iraq, a filmmaker, we can call you a filmmaker, Matt, you say you felt like you were on the wrong side of the camera there. This is a clip from the film.
There were times when I was in Iraq that I felt like I was on the wrong side of the camera. Not necessarily that I wanted to be a soldier, but I didn't want to be just a documentarian. I wanted to be shaping events around me and having an impact, not just watching.
And do you remember what it was that brought you to that self-discovery that about yourself? You wanted to be more active, you wanted to shape events. What was it?
It was going out on missions every day, seeing U.S. forces interacting with Iraqis, seeing them, you know, working on a mission, and I was just there observing. And, you know, I wanted to play more of an active role in affecting outcomes of events around me, not just being an observer.
Mm-hmm. Now, this, Matt, this came at the time when you were embedded with U.S. troops.
Right, yeah. In 2009.
Could you talk a little bit, I thought this was interesting too, about in this modern age, the interaction of cameraman, a videographer with his subjects, as you saw it there during your time as an embedded journalist?
Well, when you're filming the U.S. military, it's interesting because there's a lot of nervousness on the part of the troops at first because they don't know what your angle is. They're worried about getting in trouble if they do something on video that they shouldn't. But, you know, if you get in good with them and they like you and then you develop a personal relationship, you know, you film them and they let down their guard and you see that they are like anybody else and they like to, you know, be filmed doing what they're doing. And they are soldiers, but at the same time, they like to be seen acting as soldiers, which is perfectly fine. And so, you know, you see in the film where they want me to film them entering a building, and they like to film, you know, when they go to the range and things like this. They, you know, they're young guys, and they like to be on camera. That's our modern society. And it's something that the film touches on a lot that repeats also in Libya. When I became a fighter in Libya, and Libyan rebels were a lot like American soldiers in that regard.
It was during that time when you were with the American troops that you learned to fire a weapon.
Right. I had fired guns just a few times before that, but I would ask when I was in Iraq and also in Afghanistan, the soldiers would take me to the range, show me how things worked. I wanted to see what it was like to be behind a weapon and to learn as much as I could while I was over there. And because I had gotten in good with them and they liked me, they took me to the range and showed me how things worked. And that came in quite useful later in Libya.
Well, we're going to take our break here, Matt, and we'll come back and talk some more, pick up the story there. Matthew Van Dyke joining us this hour, producer of and the subject of the film Point and Shoot, which won Best Documentary this year at Tribeca Film Festival. Matt, a Baltimore native, recounting his adventures in the Middle East, which included joining with the rebellion in 2011 in Libya. This is Midday. Dan Rodericks, a short break. We'll be right back.
I went through Iran, crossed the border, got to Afghanistan. I got dressed as an Afghan. I'd been growing my beard out. They blended in fawly well. I bought sawed-off shotguns. I kept them under my clothes for self-defense. I ended up getting to Kabul, traveled around the country, got attacked by a village mob. I got punched in the face by a cop. Got arrested a few times.
I had my passport in my pocket.
Fire!
Fire!
I spent some time with U.S. soldiers. The more I did, the more I wanted to do. And the more I survived, the farther I thought I could push it.
Matthew Van Dyke being interviewed in the, now I can say, award-winning documentary, Point and Shoot, about his adventures in the Middle East, including North Africa, the Middle East, and then Central Asia, Afghanistan. You went to Afghanistan. You say there you dressed as an Afghan. You let your beard grow out. Matt, you also took the name Max Hunter. Tell us who this Max Hunter is.
Well, when I was traveling in the region, for the same reason I kept myself off the internet, I used aliases a few times. You know, not everybody you want to give your real name to. And also, you know, when I published sometimes a few of the articles I'd written, I used that as a pen name so that I wasn't Google searchable by foreign embassies when I would apply for visas. They don't like people coming to their country who have written articles. It makes them nervous sometimes. So that was part of my strategy to keep me off the internet. Max Hunter seemed like a good marketable name for a motorcycle adventure film also. But it was a sort of a short-lived thing. It was something I experimented with, and mostly in 2009. By 2010, I had stopped using it.
In the film, that punch, which we heard in that clip there, that punch from a police officer, this was in Afghanistan.
Yeah, that was in the Panjshir Valley in Afghanistan.
Why did he punch you? It's pretty nasty.
Well, yeah, it was. I was with an American photographer at that time, and we were driving motorcycles there, and we had stopped to buy some firewood to cook with, and the village mob attacked us, thinking that we were Taliban from the way we were dressed. And they basically pulled me off the bike. They were surrounding me. The cop came up, and just out of nowhere, he punched me in the face and arrested us.
Do you know what he said to you just before he punched you? He says something in the film, but it's not translated.
No, I don't.
Okay.
But yeah, I should get somebody to translate that and figure out what he did say. I just know the result was we ended up arrested for a few hours. Fortunately, I had a camera on around my neck, a GoPro cam on a string that they didn't notice. And, you know, a few hours later, they dropped us off at a nearby U.S. base, which is sometimes how these arrests ended up. But the U.S. forces were always good to us about it.
One last thing on that, Matt. Do you think he punched you because he suspected, as the others did, that you were Taliban?
It could be. I mean, we were on that same trip in Iraq. We had been arrested just a couple months earlier, taken to Baghdad, hooded and beaten and mock executed and accused of being Al-Qaeda. So, you know, the local security forces' idea of what's likely to be Al-Qaeda or Taliban is a little different than what you would think.
When you talk about being arrested and mistreated, punched, kicked, blindfolded, during these times, did you ever think about just going home, finding a job at Home Depot, coming back here and having a simpler life? I don't mean to demean your master's degree in Middle East studies. But I mean just coming home here and getting a job and having an easier life. Did any of that push you to the edge?
It wasn't those things. I mean, when I commit myself to something, I finish it. I mean, that's how my mother raised me. What was difficult was in the early months, the first year or so of traveling, you know, having problems with the motorcycle or having problems with financial problems, or when I was involved in essentially car smuggling in West Africa for a while and having two cars stolen and being in nearly financial ruin. These sorts of challenges early on that were the learning curve, those are the things that made me question whether to keep going when I was still, you know, on my quest for self-development. By the time I reached Iraq and the detainments and arrests by local security forces happened, it had toughened me up the time on the road before that. So those things didn't really discourage me.
After Afghanistan, did you go to Libya then?
I had been to Libya. The time in Libya was in 2008, and I was there for a month and a half. And so by the time I got to Afghanistan, that was in 2010. So I returned from Afghanistan in December 2010, told my girlfriend, that's it. Afghanistan wore me out. I'm not leaving the country for 2 years. I'm going to stay at home. We're going to have a normal life. I'm going to put these motorcycle films out. And then about 2 months later, that's when the Libyan revolution started, and I told her, sorry, I'm going to Libya. 4 years earlier, I'd set off on this crash course in manhood. And now here was the Arab Spring challenging my very image of what manhood was. I was nothing compared to people that were going out on the streets at Tripoli. There were protests being returned with gunfire.
Another clip from the film Point and Shoot. So, Matt, let me go back a couple of years then to your first time in Libya when you met Nouri, N-O-U-R-I, Libyan, who became your friend. And I think it's important that we hear who he was and what he was like.
I met Nouri actually a couple months before I even made it to Libya. I met Nouri in Mauritania. He was traveling with his cousin. Nouri was a hippie with a lot of hair and talking about peace and love. He was traveling to, I think he went to 80-some countries, mostly by foot. And I met him by chance when I had a motorcycle breakdown and ended up back in the capital in Mauritania. And he told me I should come to Libya. So when I got to Libya a month or two later, we hung out more, got to know each other, and we became really good friends.
So that was in, you said, 2008, 2009?
Yes, I first met him in 2007, and then 2008 I was in Libya.
Well, I mean, Americans, I don't think Americans, too many Americans were visiting Libya at that time.
No, it was actually impossible for Americans to visit as tourists. I had to pay a bribe and get a VIP business visa that said I worked for some company I didn't work for.
Could you, do you mind telling us a little bit about that? I'm curious about how you knew to whom to pay a bribe and how much. How did all that happen?
I was very fortunate, actually. I had emailed so many Libyan tour companies, and they all said it was impossible for me to visit Libya. Then I emailed one by chance. His name is Tariq Kabali, and he had the connections that he was the guy that could get Americans into Libya. And Tariq, I paid the money through Tariq. It went to a bribe in the visa office, got the visa, entered the country, and actually Tariq and I became good friends. I think he might have actually spent quite a bit of money on me as a guest. And I stayed for 6 weeks living in his office. Of course, I had a shower, everything there, and that's how I made such good friends. I made friends with a lot of bikers, motorcycle enthusiasts, Libyans, also Nouri and other Libyans, and Tariq, and I'm friends with all of them to this day.
And Nouri was much like yourself. You found him to be a kindred spirit.
He was. He was a traveler. We were both born in the same year. He was a free-ranging, sort of unconventional guy that was out to see the world. And other than him being a hippie and me not being a hippie, but other than that, I mean, we got along very well.
So now I'll push up a couple of years to 2010, December. We get into 2011, the Arab Spring, pushing into Libya. And do you make contact with Nouri? Or does he call you, or did you call him?
No, it was actually my Libyan biker friends and Tariq that I was talking to through Facebook and Gmail chat and things about what was happening in the revolution. And when I went over, I went to Cairo first because that's where I could fly into, was making my plans to enter Libya. And I contacted Nouri because he was the only person I knew who lived in Benghazi. And Nouri answered the phone and he said, yeah, come on, man, it's cool. So I thought Nouri was going to be his hippie self. I had no idea that he would actually be involved in the revolution. I just thought I'd get there, crash at his house a day, and then go find a unit to join. And when I got there, Nouri was at his haircut. He was wearing military clothing. He was very serious. He was already working in the revolution as a rebel. And they had the beginnings of a unit, and I joined right away.
And they had guns.
Yes, we had some guns and others. We went to a bombed out ammo and weapons depot to get more weapons.
So you weren't just coming along for the ride now. You knew you had decided you were going to join and your friends in their effort. And if that meant firing weapons, you would do that.
Right. I had a list of priorities. My first was to join as a fighter. I did not know, however, if it was possible to enter Libya and volunteer in somebody else's war, depending on how you look at it, whose war it was. But, you know, I didn't know if that was possible. So my first priority was fighter. If that wasn't possible, I would join, you know, moving supplies or trying to work at a hospital or anything I could do. But, yes, I had the intention to fight when I went.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Matthew Van Dyke, who's a producer but also the subject of the film Point and Shoot, a documentary which won Best Documentary at the Tribeca Film Festival in April. It's about his exploits traveling through the Middle East and how he came to be a part of the rebels fighting for liberation in Libya against the Gaddafi regime. So the peace and love hippie you knew as Nori, he was set for a fight.
Right. It was a time for war, and he was ready to serve his country.
And what about yourself? What had you explained about this to your mother and Lauren, your girlfriend at the time, who was figures greatly in this film, is interviewed extensively in the film about how she felt about what you were doing. What did you say to them?
I had called my mother, and I said, I'm going to go to Libya. And she said, if I was your age, I'd be doing the same thing. And then I called my girlfriend, Lauren, and said, you should come home from work. I'm going to Libya. And she was a lot less supportive. So I went. I since I wasn't sure exactly what I would be able to do when I went there, I said I was going to go help in whatever way I could. But soon after I arrived, I called, and I actually recorded some of these conversations on video with my mother, telling her I was involved in the revolution and telling Lauren as well that I was wearing a uniform, transporting equipment, that we were getting weapons. I called, asked my mother for the numbers of some family friends that were in the military so I could call them to get advice on how to use some mortars we had found. So yeah, they were fully aware very soon after I joined as a rebel about what I was doing.
So it was clear to them that you were going to be involved in a fight.
It was clear to them that at that point I was wearing a uniform and that I was serving as a rebel fighter. I didn't tell them that I would be on the front lines fighting. I told them what I'd been doing up to that point, which was, you know, getting the vehicles ready, getting weapons and ammo, transporting ammunition. At that point, that I was in a support role. But when I went to Brega for the recon mission, I told them that I was going on a reconnaissance mission. Mm-hmm. There was no need until I was going to be on the front line in combat to worry them about me being on the front line. But they knew I was a rebel fighter.
And Matt, you were able to continue filming, and did the Nori and the other men around you understand that you were going to continue to do that?
Right. Well, when we were working, I'd set the camera up and just film us while we're moving weapons and ammo. I'd shoot some video of some things. I'd hand off a camera to one of them. The idea was just that one day they could show their kids or their grandkids how they overthrew Gaddafi. I sort of took the camera as an afterthought on this one. I didn't even know if we'd survive or if the footage would survive. It was more for their sake and more of a personal thing that we were filming.
Do you remember the first time you were under fire? Because Gaddafi's forces certainly were retaliating against those who had protested and those who were rebelling.
When I was captured, I suffered a head injury and don't remember the actual capture. So I suppose that was possibly the first time. After I escaped prison, I went right back to the front line, and that would be the first time that I have a recollection of being fired on. We were in Harawa. We had just captured the town, and we thought it was clear, and all of a sudden rocket fire started coming in. And, it was, honestly, it was terrifying having rockets fly in, the noise, the explosions. We weren't sure where they were coming from. But, it would just become the first time of many.
How far away were these rockets explode from you?
Fairly close. I mean, we could hear them whizzing over in the explosions. I don't know. Everybody withdrew back out of that open town square to cover. But, there were times that the fire got quite close. I got hit by shrapnel from a mortar once. Fortunately, I was not injured. One time, while we were withdrawing from a spot because we thought we were losing air out of our tire, a round came in, an anti-aircraft round, ricocheted off the ground, flew quite close right over my head. And also just the sound of bullets every day. It's like pew, 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 like that, constantly over your head. By the afternoon, I thought I was still hearing them just from the repetitiveness of it. Nori and I had around 40 engagements with the enemy during that time of the war. And, it was very intense. Gaddafi's guys had so much ammunition, they just threw it at us all day.
And what you're describing now occurred after you spent up to 6 months in a prison.
Right. I was captured About 1 week before NATO became involved in the war, I was held in solitary confinement for nearly 6 months in two different prisons. The Gaddafi regime told the world that they didn't know what happened to me for almost that entire time, so nobody knew if I was dead or alive. And then one day, prisoners started escaping the prison, breaking locks off the cells. They broke the lock off mine. I escaped prison. I waited in Tripoli for Nouri to come, and then we went back to the front line. And then I formally joined. Now the rebels were more organized into an actual army, so I joined the National Liberation Army. Was issued a military ID, a military jeep, and I became a heavy machine gunner, and Nouri was the driver of the jeep, and also we were infantry as well.
And this is the period when, back home, we first heard about Matthew Van Dyke, first that you had disappeared, and then you were imprisoned, and then your liberation from prison, or your escape. So we'll pick up our conversation there, Matt. Another break here on Midday as we continue to hear from Matthew Van Dyke about his exploits in the Middle East, a producer of, and but more importantly, the subject of the film, Point and Shoot, winner of a Best Documentary at the Tribeca Film Festival and is now on the film festival circuit in the United States. More with Matthew Van Dyke when we get back.
In the past, it was easy to be both behind the camera and in front of the camera. But while fighting in a war, it was a more difficult thing to manage.
You feel uncomfortable because you feel, even though you're not acting, you feel like an actor. You have to be conscious of what does it look like on the camera side.
Hey, Noir, let me get another angle.
And then you wonder, you know, is this authentic? Is this genuine? Am I choosing my words a certain way? Am I doing certain actions? But at the same time, you're trying to capture reality. It's not easy to do.
Another clip from Point and Shoot, the documentary about our guest in this hour of Midday, Matthew Van Dyke, Baltimore native, who ended up as a freedom fighter in Libya during that revolution in that country in 2011. The subject of a film directed by Marshall Curry. I'm curious, Matthew, to ask you a little bit about your relationship with Marshall Curry. I mean, he's probably as fascinated by you as I am now, given what your motivations were for embarking on all this to begin with, and then what it was like for you to be dual role of trying to, create your own documentary, to document your own experience while also paying attention to this civil war in Libya, this rebellion, and your role in it as a rebel fighter. So can you talk a little bit about that, a little bit more of what you addressed in that clip, and then what interested Marshall Curry in your relationship with him?
Well, the clip is about the difficulty of filming oneself while trying to fight a war. I didn't really envision that this would be part of a documentary I was doing. And in fact, the camera, at times you'll see in the film, I thought about throwing the camera away or destroying it because I felt it was a distraction. And Nouri kept urging me that I had to film because it was history and it was Libyan history and I had to keep doing both. For sure there were times that I wanted to just get rid of the camera. I thought it was a distraction and that I thought it was too much to handle when I'm trying to do other things. But I think I struck a decent balance. Sometimes when you're fighting, you can hand the camera to somebody to film some of it, and you can film when you're at the front line, but you're not fighting yourself at the moment. But it's a tough thing to do. And yes, that was interesting to Marshall Curry as a fellow filmmaker. I approached Marshall because right after I came back from Libya, I went to work for the Syrian Revolution. So part of it was a matter of I didn't have time to really direct a feature-length documentary myself. And also because, as a filmmaker, I felt like it would, be difficult to direct a film about my own military service. Directing a motorcycle film, a motorcycle adventure film myself is no problem. But when you're talking about your own military service, for it to have credibility and some objectivity, I felt like I needed to take a step back and, allow creative control to somebody else. And it was difficult to just be a producer and cinematographer on the film, but I felt that was the responsible thing to do.
Matthew, I want to go back just to the prison days a little bit more before we go on with the story. What happened to your, speaking of camera, what happened to your camera when you were arrested and taken to these prisons?
Well, I never saw it again. You know, I made a backup of my video footage and left it with Nori a couple days before that mission that I was captured on. So I never saw that camera again. And then when I returned to the front line, I was able to get another camera to take with me.
Okay. And could you talk a little bit about prison? It sounds like it was pretty hard, pretty boring for a long period of time. How were you treated there?
It was extraordinarily difficult for the first. I was in two different prisons for the first half of it. I was in a 7x4 foot cell, let out three times a day to use the bathroom, a squat toilet in the floor that had bugs living in it that would crawl into my cell at night. I was given food and water, but otherwise I sat and I stared at the wall, thought about my life, thought about what my mother must be going through, thought about what my girlfriend must be going through. Sometimes I could hear men in other parts of the prison being tortured. I thought they would come and torture me. I trimmed down my fingernails and toenails so they couldn't rip them out. And I pretty much paced back and forth and worried. Then eventually my mind started to crack a little in solitary with some auditory hallucinations. But, you know, it was a very, very difficult time, but also a time for self-reflection and introspection. And, I think I emerged from it better, actually.
They knew you were an American.
The guards didn't. When I was captured, I had my American passport with me, and they told me I would never see America again. They thought I was CIA or Mossad. The guards were not told who I was. It was sort of a secret who I was, and I was kept in solitary in a semi-secluded part of the prison with other high-profile prisoners, Libyan or Libyan-American high-profile prisoners that I didn't even know were there. But yeah, it was the guards didn't even know. Eventually, they came and asked me.
Well, I have two questions about that. Those you encountered who realized you were an American fighting with Libyans who are seeking liberation from the dictator Gaddafi, they must have been surprised, shocked that an American was doing this. I'm assuming they were. I'd like to hear from you on that. And secondly, did you ever feel like because you were an American, you were going to become a bargaining chip of some kind?
Well, I believed I was going to be a bargaining chip, and that's part of what the auditory hallucinations from the sensory deprivation of solitary, which is a common effect of solitary confinement, it was along those lines that I thought I might be traded or used for propaganda. Why they didn't use me, it's sort of a mystery. I mean, there was also an American contractor who was an ex-Navy SEAL who I met after the war, who was held in another prison. He was never used for propaganda either. It's really strange how the regime sort of got so disorganized and falling apart that they sort of forgot to use us. Both of us would have been excellent propaganda for the regime. But the guards, I told them that I was an American and pretty much all that I needed to tell them. I didn't tell them that, I was here to fight against your side. I just said I was an American and kept as little, answer their questions as little as possible.
Right. I'm curious about how zealous these guards were or anybody else you encountered from the Gaddafi side of things, how loyal they were to Gaddafi, just how passionate they were about supporting the great dictator Gaddafi, the late Gaddafi. Did you get any of that from them, or did you think, it's not that strong, this may not last that long?
Well, from the guards, no. The guards, were just guys, mostly guys just doing their jobs. But, occasionally, when I was put on the airplane to be transported from Sirte to Tripoli to begin my prison time, a guy on the airplane kicked me a lot of times really bad. I was on the floor trying to protect myself in the airplane while he was very angry. And there was also a time at the prison, I think somebody was kicking at a door, I think trying to get into my cell block to come after me, and the guards kicked the guy away. So that didn't happen. So I didn't really get the sense that the guards, though, were that much of loyalists. Certainly when we were fighting in Sirte, they were Gaddafi's most loyal guys who were going to fight to the end, and there they certainly were. But I think a lot of us in the war were surprised at how many people fought for Gaddafi and how long the war took. Early in the war, we thought that that it wouldn't last. We didn't think it would take 8 months.
I need to ask you this question about, you know, being an American, taking on this role, this responsibility, putting yourself into this fight, how unusual this is. Have you done research into other Americans who either joined this fight in Libya or any of the fights in the Middle East or in any other civil wars anywhere on the globe, anywhere in the last 100 years? It sounds like a kind of a crazy question, but I think you may not be singularly unique in this regard, but it's pretty unusual, Matt.
It's unusual for current times. Since after the war, you know, people said it was unusual, and I went and did some research to find out if it was that unusual. You know, it turns out in the Spanish Civil War, a few thousand Americans went, along with the 20 to 30,000 is the estimate, foreigners who fought in Spain against Franco. Mm-hmm. You know, and throughout history this has happened. There was an American who was part of the Cuban Revolution, who held the same rank as Fidel Castro and Che Guevara. His name was William Alexander Morgan, an American who was involved in that. I mean, it's, you know, for my generation, maybe it's a bit odd, but, you know, in a historical context, I don't think it's that strange. I mean, I developed a connection to Libya. I had personal friends there. I'd seen the effects of authoritarianism, not just in Libya, but throughout the region. I had an academic background in it as well, and I, you know, saw a cause that I think I thought I could have an impact on, and I went and did what I believed in, and I continued to do in Syria and elsewhere, hopefully in the future.
What do people of your generation who didn't do this, and there are many, say to you about your experience? Old friends, anybody you've encountered, new friends, Americans of, you know, in their 20s or 30s, what do they say? What kind of comments do you get from people?
You know, 99% are positive and supportive. You know, I have a good relationship with, you know, ex-U.S. military really like it. When I was just at the Little Rock Film Festival, I was hanging out with two guys from Sebastian Younger's new film, Korangal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's people support me. I do what I believe in, and I put my life on the line for it, and I don't think too much not to like about that. So I don't get too much criticism.
What do you call yourself? We know that you didn't like being called a journalist. That was a mistake we kind of made at the beginning of this when you were first reported missing in 2011. What do you consider yourself now, Matt? Filmmaker?
Primarily a revolutionary. Also a filmmaker, an activist filmmaker.
Let's talk about Syria. Because last time you were on our show, you had been to Syria. And I don't know that I realized that you had made a film yourself. Not anymore, A Story of Revolution. Could you talk a little bit about that?
It's a film I made it was released in 2013. I went to Syria in 2012, in October and November. I spent about a month in the country in Aleppo. I filmed a young woman journalist, Noor, and a young male rebel fighter, Malia. And the film is basically, it's a 15-minute short that I've released on YouTube so people can watch it for free. I want as many people to see as possible. It's a film about them talking about why they're having a revolution and some of their experiences. And it's a very intensely emotional film. I sent a copy of the DVD to every member of Congress. It's been in well over 100 film festivals around the world and in nearly 20 countries. And it's won 49 awards. It was a deeply personal project. I self-financed it. It cost me about $30,000. Which I'm about break even on it finally after all this time. But you know, it was at the time it was war by another means for me. I wanted to go fight in Syria, but the rebels didn't have weapons and ammunition or international support. So it didn't make sense to go do that. I wanted to, everything I do for a revolution, I want to do maximizing my time and effort for the greatest effect. So I thought I would make a film that would help move public opinion to support the revolution. I did the best I could with it. You know, I'm disappointed it hasn't moved public opinion enough. But, you know, it was shown on TV in some other countries. Millions of people have seen it through television. And, you know, I've tried. I'm still trying. I still spend a lot of time trying to promote that movie just so people see it and releasing it with subtitles in other languages. But
here's an excerpt from it, Matt, that we'll play for our audience. This is the journalist you just referred to, Noor, explaining why she insists on covering the war.
So many girls died in the kitchen, like doing a dishwasher or cooking something. And we have, like, a mortar shell or a shrapnel coming through the window and they're, like, drop dead. So what's the point? Why should I keep? So I have to go. I have to do this. I'm not afraid of death.
She puts her life at risk covering the war in Syria. Now, that was from that actual scene you shot, 2 years ago now? A year and a half ago? Yeah. And it's still going on. And my question for you was, did Libya compared to the experience in Syria in terms of who's rebelling? Was it clear to you in Libya, it was clear to you who you were fighting with and what you were fighting for? Was it a little more confusing in Syria?
You know, in Syria, primarily, people are fighting for the same things. They want freedom. They want democracy. They want a downfall of an authoritarian regime. There's some people who are also fighting for religion. There's some people who are fighting for a variety of reasons, just like any war. At the end of the day, I don't really care as long as they shoot in the right direction at the regime's forces. Mm-hmm. You know, people use the complexity of the Syrian conflict as an excuse for inaction or for a reason to not support it, which I think is a very wrong approach. You know, the beating heart of this revolution is the same motivations that we fought for in Libya, and those people deserve the world's support.
What happens next, Matt? Just tell us a little bit about the film, Point and Shoot. It's been on the film festival circuit. Will that continue?
Yes, it'll be at AFI Docs in Washington, D.C. soon in June. I'll be at those screenings to answer audience questions and meet people. And it'll be at other film festivals around the country. There'll be a theatrical release in some movie theaters later this year. And the film will be on television. I know in the United States it'll be on PBS, on POV on PBS. It'll also be on BBC and some other networks around the world.
That's all excellent. And the other film, the one that you made about Syria, Not Anymore, A Story of Revolution, you say that can be seen online for free?
Yes, you can go to SyrianRevolutionFilm.com to get the link to it on YouTube, or if you search on YouTube for Syria Film, it should be the first thing that comes up.
Hey, Matt, it was nice to talk to you again.
Nice talking to you, too. Anytime. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and congratulations on the film, Point and Shoot, winner of Best Documentary at the Tribeca Film Festival. Our guest has been Matthew Van Dyke, its subject. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Hope you enjoyed Midday. See you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at wypr.org. Dan Rogic's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.